Okay, thank you very much, Gillian, and thank you so much, everyone, for coming here today. It's great to see such a kind of wide set of people from so many different organisations, those who have, those who haven't contributed to the evidence process. I'd like to also thank Landor for the organisation that's gone on behind the scenes of the event, and without whom I would probably be shaking a little bit more than I currently am anyway. So All Change, the future of travel demand and the implications for policy and planning. Well, before I go into the findings of the report, I just want to say a little bit about the Commission. So Gillian's said the Commission for Travel Demand was set up as part of a Research Council's UK energy project. That centre was called Demand. Do a small flyer for this. Demand. The chair, the head of the Demand Centre is sat over there, Elizabeth Shove. Thanks to her and Gordon Walker for having the faith and interest in the work we were trying to achieve through the Commission. But you can find lots and lots of insights if you like the kind of thinking and discussion that's in this report. There's lots and lots of materials available. There's loads of postcards here to take away. It's not very heavy to carry. There are also some research insights. You can find out about all sorts of other aspects of consumption and demand that I think have informed the thinking in this report. The Commission is not a research project, though. It was established very much to function as a royal commission, except that I'm not royal and no one commissioned it. I commissioned it. But in every other way, it's very similar to a royal commission. So first, a team of commissioners from across academia and practice were formed, and I owe these people a great debt of thanks. So Elaine Seagriff from Jacobs, Peter Jones, OBE from UCL, Nicola Sperling from the Institute for Social Futures at Lancaster, and John Dales from Urban Movement. You will hear a little bit from each of them later about something they've taken away from the report, their thinking. We began with a call for evidence, and we ran six evidence sessions. And you can see from the pie chart that the process generated a substantial volume of interest, and it grew over time, which was very rewarding. We had 28 pieces of written evidence and 59 participants in the six oral evidence sessions, a real mix of national government, local government, NGOs, consultants, individuals, academics. That mixture is absolutely central to me in this report making, or having the opportunity to make a difference. Whilst the report is the Commission's, it's very much built on the evidence that we received, and you'll see that in the style of the reporting. Okay, so a takeaway message. And I think this is really important because, for me, in my career, the debate has not moved on. And I think we've now gone through a substantial period of time where the relationships between how much, how often, when, and how we travel and the activities that we take part in have changed. And it wasn't just a one-off thing that happened. We're in the middle of an ongoing process of change. We always have been within transport planning, but just the nature of that change is quite distinct from what it was in earlier periods. And the implications, as I'm hoping I'll convince you of in the presentation today, are huge. These are the key topics that we're working through today. You can follow where we are in the presentation, so you know how much longer you've got to listen to me, by where we are on the coloured bars, and there's a little tab on the side that you can easily follow. Okay, so why does the demand for travel matter? So you wouldn't be here if you didn't believe that demand for travel mattered, but I'm almost certain we've got some very different opinions on why it matters in the room. So we argue in the report that it's at the centre of public policy debates in transport, or rather it should be. Its absence or marginalisation from much of the transport policy discourse is therefore really striking. First, in health terms, too much traffic in parts of our cities contributes to personal security, safety and air quality concerns. So we know 44 of 51 towns over the WHO PM2.5 limit, over 100 roads not going to be compliant with NO2 limits by 2021. When we look at the role of active travel and the demand for active travel, well, there's rather than too much, there's too little. Only 66% of men and 58% of women managing the recommended 150 minutes of exercise, moderate exercise per week. One in three children in year six overweight or obese. These, of course, should be national scandals. On climate, the Committee on Climate Change has a suggested pathway out to 2030 which requires a 44% reduction in transport emissions. However, transport emissions have risen, as they say in their recent report, 3 years in a row to their highest level since 2009, which reflects rising demand for travel and a slowing in progress of the improvement of efficiency of new vehicles. I'll return to this shortly, but I want to be clear that travel demand is a key and not a marginal variable in the future vector of carbon emissions, and I'm not sure why we can't have that discussion. There are also major public policy, spending and accountability issues. Transport is the sector with the highest infrastructure pipeline spend out to 2021. That's £90 billion. We justify this spending in times of public spending austerity on the basis of demand projections which stretch out 30 to 60 years hence. However, as is becoming increasingly obvious, and I'll talk a bit more about this, we're not even so sure about the near-term future of demand trends as we thought we were. So whilst there'll always be disagreement about the extent to which demand is a policy problem in itself, I think this chart from the Committee on Climate Change's assessment of the Clean Growth Strategy tells an unequivocal story. So the least cost pathway modelled requires a 60% of new car and van sales to be ultra-low emission vehicles, e.g. electric, by 2030. It also requires major improvements in the efficiency of new vehicles, a big shift to biofuels, and the Committee on Climate suggests a 5% reduction in travel demand below baseline levels by 2030. We'll talk a little bit about what the baseline means as we go through, but if that chart was a health check from your doctor, you'd be worried. Of course, one of the responses to having such a large policy gap in the transport sector could be to think about lower demand futures so that we close the gap. That probably raises alarm bells about the war on the motorist. However, I'm going to try and paint more of a positive policy picture by looking at what is actually unfolding on the ground in front of us. So to the next section, the demand for travel has changed. So this chart will be quite familiar to most of you. It shows how radically the demand for travel changed over the period since the 1950s. The growth in car ownership and the associated reordering of land uses and lifestyles was one of the defining social changes of the past century. In the 1950s, fewer than 20% of households owned a car. Today, 74% of households have at least one car. Distances travelled on roads have increased hugely, more than tenfold since the 1950s, to the current level of 323 billion vehicle miles. And so, the science of transport planning also co-evolved in the period of growth. The approaches adopted to estimating future travel demand have, quite reasonably, been based on trying to understand how car ownership and use might grow over time. These were the dominant factors in a big social change. The key factors attributed to demand growth have been income, fuel prices, population, and network capacity. Thinking and practicing about road and rail growth have taken different paths, and we've been less interested in what goes on in terms of the local transport usage. Nonetheless, growth first slowed in vehicular traffic and then stopped. Over a similar time period, we had a recession and growth continued on the rail network, to the surprise of many people. So cue furious debate, what is actually going on? So let's have a look at some of the evidence underneath this. For the past 25 years, there's evidence that we have been travelling less than we used to. So we make 16% fewer trips than we did in 1996. We spend 22 hours less travelling than we did a decade ago. And we travel 10% fewer miles than we did in 2002. I'll go on to talk about some of the reasons that might explain this, but a critical point to note is that transport planning in all of its guises, from theory and classroom to practice, has been a discipline that sought to explain growth. No one advanced to us any evidence which suggests that these shifts had been foreseen, or indeed that we knew where they were going. That's not to say that there isn't some really good work out there trying to understand these trends. You'll see some of it shortly. But I would say we're really at a descriptive stage. So dominated has our thinking been about the relationships between income and car ownership and growth in travel that we've neglected the why of why people travel. It's not a blip, as Gillian said earlier. It's not the internet or the economy or the recession. It predates both of those. They're both surely important, but they're not the explanation. There is no one single simple explanation to this. It represents a secular decline in how much we travel on average per person in the UK. And the only reason that we saw, rather than a decline, stability and very low growth rates in terms of traffic on our road network, rather than a decline, is that we've had population growth. And the distribution of that population has been focused on particular centres. So the population of the UK grew by 13% between 1996 and 2016. Road traffic grew by 13% between 1996 and 2016. So what underpins this decline? Well, the evidence from Gordon Stokes, Kieran Chatterjee and colleagues was particularly informative in looking at age and cohort effects. And I strongly recommend the 2018 report by Kieran, colleagues at UWE and Oxford, for the Department for Transport on younger people's travel. These charts give a visualisation of how the change in travel behaviour across cohorts is happening. So using data from the 1995 to 2014, the left-hand chart shows males, the right-hand chart shows females. And the data is the percentage of people recording a driver trip in the National Travel Survey week. So what we can see is a significant decline, particularly for males, but it also occurs for females, particularly in the younger category, but also still within the middle-aged category, in the number of driver trips recorded. What we also see at the other end of the distribution is the anticipated increase in travel for over 60s. The baby boomer generation is reaching retirement. It's replacing a cohort which was traditionally far less dependent on the car throughout of its life course, and therefore they're travelling more relative to their peers. So we anticipated one end of the spectrum, but we weren't anticipating what followed on behind that. So why has this reduction happened? To which the short answer is, it's a long answer. There's a whole range of factors from the economy through house prices, education trends, delayed parenting, different social preferences. Chatterjee and colleagues state the causes lie largely outside of transport. So that's a major challenge to our current approach of trying to explain how transport is changing. It's not a recessionary blip. That's not the same as saying the recession doesn't matter, just that it's less realistic to imagine all of these changes somehow being undone to put us back into the same context that we were in the mid-1990s. Things have changed. What will that mean for demand in the future? Well, Gordon Stokes' analysis, which you can find on our website, shows that in previous generations, when you've accessed a car later in your life, you're going to use it less than your peers who had accessed a car earlier in their life. So car later might also mean car less. However, to understand that requires us looking into why people are travelling and why they're travelling less in the first place. I'm particularly grateful to Peter Hedicar for his evidence and insights on spatial change. This chart from his recent analysis of the NTS released earlier this year shows the relationship between age and spatial location. And I think it's particularly powerful because it shows that on average, the decline in per capita driving is happening everywhere for under 60s. This is not some hipster urban lifestyle choice. Yes, the decline is stronger within Greater London and some of our other cities where the alternative transport networks make those opportunities easier. But it's not just happening in the cities, it's happening everywhere for the under 60s, and it's happening nowhere for the over 60s, where there's a rise in the amount of traffic. This is not the narrative about traffic growth which I hear. Peter makes the point that land use changes slowly, and so we can make some difference to the shape of future travel demand by where we locate development and also where population growth is encouraged. He estimates in his analysis population-related change accounted for 14% of the change in car travel. It's not insignificant how we do our land use planning, but it's not the complete explanation. The story is even more nuanced when we look within large urban areas. This is something a nationally led approach is obviously less well suited to pick up. So we have evidence from Bristol which shows a decline in traffic on A roads, which is the red line, and the green line is traffic into the city in the morning peak. There is, however, around Bristol, a growth in motorway traffic of 15% over that time period. Greater Manchester shows similar evidence. Traffic levels outside the M60, so not necessarily central Manchester here, we're talking about quite a way out from the middle of Manchester, flat over a 20-year period. Declines within the M60 and even bigger declines in the city centre, yet a rise in motorway traffic. Highways England pointed to a growth in long-distance trips, but cross-boundary trips and long-distance travel is something that we don't understand particularly well. Whose problem is that? And finally, there's evidence from Buckinghamshire which reminded us that where few alternatives exist and there's population growth, we shouldn't be surprised to continue to see traffic growth. But we need to be very careful to understand growth as an aggregation of some very different trends in different places. And so we turn perhaps to the obvious, Transport Lecture 101, travel is a derived demand. We only travel to take part in activities, which is often followed, obviously not in my courses, by Lecture 102, which is anyway, let's get on with managing or modelling travel, and the activities are presumed to largely remain the same. There are some other colleagues in the room who've probably got different curricula as well. We've been ignoring some very important social changes. To the left, the change in commute patterns. This is work from Scott Levine and colleagues, commissioned again by the Department for Transport and released late last year. It's on commuting. So it shows that between 1988-92 and 2013-14, there has been a downward trend in the number of commuting trips per person from 7.1 journeys per worker per week to 5.7. We've never had more people in the country. We've never had more people in employment. Yet the total number of commute trips has fallen from 8.5 billion to 7.9 billion per year. Commuting is falling. Commute distances have increased, but this is largely in the part-time rather than the full-time market. Again, this is not a narrative I hear about what's happening and what we need to do in order to engender greater productivity within the UK. So it seems to be where, as much as how much, the commuting is happening which is causing the congestion hotspots. It's not some never-ending, inevitable rise in the commute. There are lots of reasons, again, for this, such as the changing job market, more people not having a usual place of work, more home working, fewer people commuting 5 days a week. We make investments based on the number of jobs we'll create, and there's lots of creative thinking about how we should do that within our modelling frameworks. But what do we really know about the future of work and the relationship that it has with mobility? On the other side of the chart, shopping is a more readily understood example. But again, I see no real understanding of where this is going. So there's been a decline in trips and distance travelled, which far predates the green rise in online shopping. So online shopping is clearly driving significant changes in the retail sector. But there are things beyond that that we need to understand. There's been a 30% decline in trips per capita and a 10% decline in distance shopping in the past decade. So what's going on? But importantly, where will this end? What do our current tools tell us about what we could anticipate in 10 years' time from the retail sector? So the demand for travel has changed, and the categories we use to understand travel are now outdated. What is a shopping trip? Well, I can define some shopping trips in the way that I might have done 20 or 30 years ago, but given the variety of options that you have for visiting, purchasing, collecting, receiving, and returning goods, it's very difficult to say what a shopping trip is. Scott Levine and colleagues make a similar point about commute, and I looked at the definition of commuting. I don't have a usual place of work. I'd be grateful if you don't retweet that to University of Leeds. But as an addendum to this point on categories, One of the biggest anticipated sources of growth in traffic in the coming years is van traffic, 78% growth forecast by 2040. However, we know almost nothing about what is in fact a very disparate sector. Is it even a meaningful grouping to talk about vans? Surely this needs to be treated differently. Van traffic is associated to use. How did we even arrive at a 78% growth forecast when we seem to know very little about the sector altogether? So does this matter, before I move on to the future of travel demand? Well, this chart shows two scenarios from the 2015 National Road Traffic Forecasts. The difference between the two scenarios is that scenario three, the grey line, assumes a continued decline in trip rates at the same rate that we've seen over the last 20 years, whereas scenario one does not continue that reduction. By 2040, that adds up to a difference of 70 billion vehicle miles per year. And over the period, that adds up to 1.1 trillion vehicle miles per year. So yes, understanding where this is going really, really does matter. And business as usual, at least in the cities, seems to be suggesting the need for major infrastructure investment, which might be significantly inflated. This chart shows data from the 2015 Leeds Draft Development Plan. Shows the changes in traffic levels in Leeds between 1990 and 2015, and then what the development plan and the tempo forecast suggest might happen. The data suggests a trend reversal in almost all of the data lines, some turning through 90 degrees. The growth rates, which are implied, exceed anything that we've seen since the mid-1990s, if at all, over that time period. So if I superimpose the gradient of the all-day and the 24-hour cordon growth back from 1990, that's where we would be today. It's not like Leeds is a stagnant backwater that hasn't grown in the period since 1990. Go Leeds. Not yet on the marketing board. But ONS is not predicting a greater growth in population than has been seen over that time period. In fact, if anything, it's likely to be slightly less than we had over the period from 1990. So what is it that's going to create such a trend-breaking set of behaviours? I'm not saying there's no case for road investment and road development in Leeds, but if we start from the position that our forecasts tell us it's necessary, then we shouldn't be surprised if we begin to self-fulfil some of that demand that may not necessarily need to be there. So, to the future of travel demand, I'm pretty sure that most people in this room have been to a conference or two where the discussion is focused on where next for the transport system. Drones, pods, robots, Hyperloop, there deliberately aren't any people on this slide. So this was a very difficult evidence session to conduct. There is very little evidence about the impacts of these technologies. There are very few of these technologies out there on the streets today. So what do we know? Well, a recent US review concluded the degree of variance in all of the studies that are done about what might happen is incredibly high, and we have very few which are based on observed trends. So we're not quite shooting in the dark, but almost. So what were we able to pull out of the evidence we received? Well, first, the places that have got the basics of good integrated transport and ticketing, high-quality cycling and walking, have much higher rates of sustainable transport mode share. This is all the underpinnings of an integrated mobility as a service, and so if we want that, then we know what we need to do more of and what we need to do less of. What of sharing, which in my view is incredibly important to whether the future developments in technology will make any difference to how sustainable moving around might become? Well, unfortunately, our evidence suggests that despite some increase in access to shared mobility, such as car clubs, there's been a reduction in the sharing of the vehicle as an individual asset, partly as we've got an ageing population who have more of these assets than their previous generation had. So although we're using vehicles less, we're not necessarily having less of these assets and resources around in the system. Vehicle occupancy fell by 2.5% in the last 15 years. Uber and Lyft services. Well, there have been some important changes in terms of the volume of these services available in cities in the UK, but unfortunately none of the cities can yet tell us what the impact of this is on travel. We looked at San Francisco, which is probably the most heavily utilised Uber-Lyft type system. 20% of their vehicle miles are done in the city area in these kinds of vehicles. It's most heavily used outside of core public transport hours. Very few people are frequent users, so they're using it in addition to rather than instead of. There has been some replacement of car ownership, but there's also been some substitution of public transport, cycling and walking. So is this a revolution? Is it desirable? And under what conditions would be questions I would ask. There certainly will be more of it. As for autonomous vehicles, there are so many different models of deployment, and I would suggest it's entirely open for public policy to decide what, where and how it wants to accommodate these developments, that I think we ought to take a little bit more agency in what we want the future of autonomous vehicles to be, rather than just estimating what the demand could be. But there was a study done by colleagues at Leeds who looked at evidence across the US, and they reckon an increase of plus 5 to plus 60%. A very different context, but a very broad range. This is adding to the uncertainty we have about where travel demand may go. But I would go back to the red top slides that we've just been talking about, which is, let's remember, the activities that we take part in are changing, and so is their relationship with mobility. The future of travel demand is not just about technology, it's about where society is going and what we're travelling to take part in. So yes, we need to understand these new mobility options, but we need to understand them in the context of how will they make a difference to what society is doing. So we need to go back to our list of questions about, well, how's healthcare technology going to evolve? What will changing pension provision mean to travel in later life? Will children be staying at home longer post 18? What will the future of work look like? And how do these technologies connect in to any of that? It has to be technology and social change thought through together. And I would argue that these social changes are going to be unfolding over the next 10, 20 years at a scale which most of the innovations are not going to be evolving. So we ought to be paying more attention to this and a bit less attention to some of the demand implications that may come further down the line. So moving on to our discussions that we had about the implications for decision-making. So if we think there exists a range of factors, changing employment, shopping, healthcare, social trends, as well as changing transportation technologies that might change the future of travel, how should we deal with this looking ahead? Well, we looked at three different options in the report, and there are more, and I think there's much more work to be done on this. The first would be to widen the fan of uncertainty, and Glenn Lyons will talk a bit more about this later on. But, for example, we could allow the introduction of autonomous vehicles to be a scenario which created additional demand as we look further into the future. Or we could imagine a much more intensive shared economy that produced a reduction in travel demand. One thing that puzzled me as I was thinking through this is, why are all the lines always straight? Wouldn't it make sense to have a trend line that wasn't always going in one direction? What if the younger people who are driving less today continue to drive less into their retirement and that wave follows through and catches up? Demand is not always going to head in one direction. But nonetheless, that's maybe a quirk of me sitting at my desk for too long. But other work that I did with Glenn suggested that even with this level of uncertainty, even with putting multiple scenarios out there, looking at different oil prices and different GDP levels, it's really difficult to deal with the level of uncertainty that that implies. So whilst at the conceptual stage, we can all say, yes, of course, there are multiple demand futures. But when it comes down to actually making some decisions about what it is that we want to invest in, we end up using scenario one. I don't want to pick too much on scenario one. It just happens to be the one that is used. So the Committee on Climate Change, Highways England, scheme developers through Tempro, they essentially work with this as a de facto core scenario. It's never stated anywhere that this is a core scenario, nor is it stated that this is the most likely future that we might have. And what we do is we take this as our central point, and then we look at uncertainty around that. But that's not the same as asking whether proposals are sensible in alternative futures. It's not the same I've just said what I was going to say. So we can move on to a second option, which is to move to a more what's called robust approach. And I know Mark will argue that the current approach that the Department for Transport takes is robust. This is robust in a kind of different academic terminology. But this is something which the Dutch Ministry has begun to do. So what they've done is they've established a futures lab. And what they do in the futures lab is they develop different social futures, which they then ask each different department to interpret in its own particular domain. They then look at schemes and say, well, are these schemes sensible in these alternative futures? Those which are sensible in all of the futures, go ahead. Those which are particularly dependent on one trend emerging or not are put on the watch and wait scheme, and they wait for the evidence to emerge before they decide to commit to them. So this is more of an adaptive decision-making approach. In the oral evidence, which is the slide you've got here, Glenn described workshops with 100 transport planners, and they were looking at possible future scenarios for travel. The scenarios came from the work that he did in New Zealand, and they've got different levels of traffic growth there in the middle with the arrows. So from an increase of 35% to a decrease of 53%. And I don't want to go too much into the detail of it, but there were 100 transport planners in the UK, and the bold figures represent the numbers of people who thought that this was going to be the most likely scenario, both initially at the start of the day and then through a process of deliberative discussion. What strikes me is how uncomfortably split that is, given the divergence in the possible futures there are, and what a contrast that is to a deterministic single scenario approach that we currently adopt today. So why do we think that our technical scenario is more robust in some way? How do we close that gap? The third approach turns the question on its head, and it says, rather than imagining that there's a demand future out there somewhere, separate from policy, that we can then decide whether we're going to fulfil or not, it says that policy should be steering developments in desirable directions, and Nicola Kane will talk a bit more about this decide and provide type approach in her presentation. So take York here on the left, late 1960s, early 1970s, St Stephen's Square. And underneath what you see today with lots of tables there. So what is the demand for parking in St Stephen's Square? Well, we could have forecast it. We could have built some multi-storey car parks. But actually what we decided was that that wasn't the future. So we're not interested in asking the question about what the future of parking demand is in St Stephen's Square. We wouldn't have known anything about the demand for sitting at tables from looking at the chart at the top there. And this is the approach which has been adopted in New York with its interim public plaza program and its handing over of road space to bike lanes. It's happening in Paris. It's trying to take control and shape what we can influence, because many of the social changes go well beyond transport, but shape what we can to influence it to bring the demand that we want to see. You'll hear a bit more about parking and as an example from Nicholas Sperling later as well. We took evidence from Oslo. There, the Norwegian government has asked all cities to prepare plans for growing their cities without traffic growth. It's early days in that experiment, but they're developing at density around nodal transport points in the suburbs, and they're taking traffic out of the city centre. It's perfectly legitimate to take a different approach to planning for transport, but it would likely require a shake-up of the way we think about the value for money of different investments and what we're investing for in the first place. So I'm going to turn now to our 10 recommendations before we open it for questions. It's important to state or restate that the Commission has no statutory status except in my house, and therefore no one is required to respond to these recommendations. Nonetheless, such has been the level of engagement with the work of the Commission and the joint spirit of trying to make progress across what, frankly, are very difficult issues to think about how we might approach and change, that I hope they will form a catalyst for action, and that's one of the things we'd like to discuss through the day. I'll also preface the recommendations by reinforcing how engaged the Department for Transport has been in the whole process. It's covered a range of divisions, but in particular Mark Ledbury and his team, and Mark will talk about some of the developments that are already underway in the department. We've drawn on some really important fact-finding studies that have been published by the department, also organisations like Transport for London. To me, there feels like there's a culture of openness and transparency in the discussions, which is critical to new ideas being able to make a difference. So I feel really rewarded by the way the process has gone. So to our recommendations. Recommendation one, we think the UK should mirror the approach being adopted in the Netherlands, establish a futures lab which looks at a whole range of social as well as technological trends. It should be a meeting house to bring together reports and insights from a broad range of stakeholders. There's probably much to build on from the future, the Foresight study on future mobility. We suggest that, though, perhaps the National Infrastructure Commission might be a better home for this, as it cuts across departmental remits. They've been commissioning work trying to piece some of this together already. This then could inform our transport futuring work. Recommendation two, travel demand futures ought to be more open source. There is no one source of truth about the future, as I hope the evidence here has suggested. Yet as a sector, we remain remarkably beholden to some long-established technical processes of creating demand futures, the passenger demand forecasting handbook, the national transport model. As yet, both of these are confined to a relatively small group of users and for different reasons. We're aware that there are moves within the department to make the national transport model more open access. That's extremely welcome. But we'd also encourage a greater plurality of tools to be developed. The IPCC does not rely on one global climate forecast, yet we seem to have one dominant transport tool. Recommendation three is greater devolved input to demand futures. As we showed in the evidence, there are important differences between and even within urban areas which require a detailed understanding of local context. And I think there are also different directions being plotted in terms of what wants to happen within the different cities. We have a process of devolution where the evidence base is of a high quality. Why not support that by allowing them to take greater control over what they think their demand futures should be, with the department moving more to a quality assurance type role? Recommendation four is a longer-term ex-post evaluation evidence base, maybe not the most eye-catching of our 10 recommendations, but really important. There is not a very strong tradition of long-term evaluation in the transport sector. Highways England has the best database of information about what happens after they implement projects. They have a post-scheme opening database for 1 and 5 years after opening. The department's been expanding its monitoring and evaluation programme of work, but whilst going beyond 5 years is difficult, is it enough? Are we really very good at going back and learning the lessons about the forecasts that we make and taking that into account in our future decision-making processes? So we've recommended the Department for Transport and its chief scrutineer, the National Audit Office, work together on this. The second set of recommendations fall under decision-making processes, and I think this is a particularly difficult area. So we suggest that there should be a shift to more adaptive decision-making approaches. Certainly the current practice of operating with a core or preferred scenario, whether it's clearly stated or not, is not defensible. With this, I think we get drawn into a disproportionate depth of analysis and focus around one particular core scenario at the exclusion of other opportunities or alternatives. As we set out in recommendation one, we think there should be a greater shift towards a more scenario-based approach, and therefore we need to think about the methods that would go along with that. This is not something that we should jump into. We need to develop and pilot tests on things like assumption-based planning or robust decision-making and adaptive policy-making. We should be piloting alternative ways of approaching this so we can learn the lessons about where the strengths and weaknesses of the different approaches are. I would avoid using right and wrong. What we will know is that all futuring processes will be wrong in some dimensions. Okay, it's about strengths and weaknesses of different approaches. Recommendation six is we need to be aware of ramping up the analytical burden of lots and lots of new tools. So perhaps we need to simplify some of the approaches, given that actually we don't know so much about what's happening further down the line. So again, we ask here the Department and the UK Research and Innovation to fund work which explores how we could do that, what sorts of tools might work. But also, I think you have to work with decision makers. How do we talk to decision makers about the fact that actually there's some stuff here that we're not as sure about as you might want us to be? Without losing professional credibility and being able to communicate that in ways that they can work with. So policy recommendations, specific policy recommendations. For the Department for Transport and the Committee on Climate Change, even within the National Road Traffic Forecast 2015, we showed that the difference of one assumption on trip rates could make a difference to the total vehicle miles travelled of 1.1 trillion. These are so significant that it's necessary for the Department and the Committee on Climate Change to develop estimates of what the carbon implications are of these alternative futures. And there should be some commentary on the desirability and feasibility or practicability of dealing with carbon reduction in each of these different scenarios. Some of them clearly make life easier, and some of them make life a lot more difficult. Recommendation 8 is to address the divergence between motorway and urban area growth. This really needs to be understood. So we showed the evidence earlier about the gap between what's going on the motorway network and what's going on in urban areas. Highways England is interested in this, but it's historically been better at knowing when vehicles come onto its network and when they leave the network, and they're not so interested in what happens in the bits either side. They know that's important, but it's not their remit. These are transboundary trips, so we're not particularly good at capturing those within our own survey. So relatively little is known about long-distance trips, and we think there's an urgent need to close that gap. Recommendation 9 is that green growth city futures should be established. And there are opportunities within perhaps some of the new funding calls from the department here. But there's an opportunity to capitalise on the trends in per capita travel reduction that we've seen in major cities. I think one of the reasons we haven't seen action happen to do that is because we've spent time wondering when things are going to go back to the way they were. Other countries, other places, other cities have seen that as a chance, and they've started planning differently and trying to capitalise on that trend and to make it work for society. So we need to invest in ways which support that. So whilst we've got pressures on for delivering housing development, and Keith Mitchell will talk a bit more about this, they're currently on a fairly car-dependent set of assumptions. So the department needs to be funding trials that seek to develop growth in cities, which is less dependent on travel, not more dependent on travel. Recommendation 10. Again, probably not one of the eye-catching ones, but still, I think, important. So we say that travel is a derived demand. The relationships between the activities we take part in, when and where they're organised, are critical in terms of how much we travel. Yet we still see decisions made across a whole set of different policy areas which externalise the transport impacts of them because they're of secondary importance to that organisation or budget holder. This cuts both ways. Some policies will probably reduce the amount we travel, but some stand out. The continued reorganisation of the health service, for example, as potentially generating additional travel needs. So we suggest that each government department should have its own set of shadow transport accounts, and we should begin to shine a light on the different decisions which make a difference to the amount of travel demand that we see. So I'll bring the presentation to a close and open for questions, which Gillian will chair, with the takeaway message to repeat the relationships between how much, how often, when and how we travel and the activities we take part in have changed. Do your decision makers, do your local and national decision makers understand that? And they continue to change. That will be important over the coming decades. We need to change our approach to understanding this today and to what difference it makes to how we plan as we look ahead. I'm hoping you'll agree with me that the implications of this are huge. Thank you very much.